From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
By 1804, the slave armies defeated Napoleon's legions, making Haiti the first independent black republic in the world.
It is the 200th anniversary of Haiti.
And it is an occasion for Asian Americans and African Americans all over to celebrate.
Today, we will go to Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And we will also talk about this 10th anniversary of the Zapatista Uprising.
These companeros are supporters in struggle. They have been and continue to be the backbone of the EZLN. They are the ones who fed us, who protected us secretly. They are civilian representatives. They're just like you.
Subcomandante Marcos and more. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli government has arrested one of its own soldiers in connection with the shooting of Tom Herndl in the Gaza Strip last April that left the British activist clinically dead. Herndl, who was unarmed, was shot on April 11th in the head while visiting the Rafah refugee camp as a member of the International Solidarity Movement. He was pronounced clinically dead at the time and has been since living in a vegetative state. Palestinian witnesses said at the time of the shooting, Herndl was trying to pull two Palestinian children out of danger. The Israeli soldier, who has not been identified, originally claimed he only returned fire at a man armed with a pistol. Later, after a long investigation, the soldier admitted he shot at an unarmed civilian. In Baghdad, up to 8 people died on New Year's Eve when a car bomb blew up outside a Christian-run restaurant that was hosting a New Year's Eve party. More than 30 people were injured, including 3 journalists with the Los Angeles Times. The restaurant was popular with foreigners in part because it served alcohol. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has announced it plans to replace almost all the troops in Iraq over the next 5 months by sending in 110,000 fresh troops and Marines and pulling the 120,000 troops currently on the ground. Air Force General Richard Myers, chair of the military's Joint Chiefs of Staff, called the rotation, quote, a logistics feat that will rival any in history. Air Force Myers went on to admit, quote, there's going to be a lot of turbulence in the system. The Washington Post is reporting the United States is planning to create in Baghdad its largest diplomatic mission in the world with a staff of more than 3,000. Newly released British documents show that President Nixon considered sending in U.S. forces to seize oil fields in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Abu Dhabi in 1973 during the Middle East oil embargo. Britain learned of the top-secret plan in a memo from Nixon's defense secretary, James Schlesinger. In an interview with the New York Times, Libya's Prime Minister, Shukri Ghanem, has warned that if the United States does not lift sanctions on his country by May 12th, Libya will reconsider paying out the remaining $6 million promised to each family of victims killed on Pan Am Flight 103. USA Today is reporting North Korea has agreed to let a group of U.S. experts visit its top nuclear facility next week between January 6th and January 10th. The trip will mark the first time anyone from the international community has visited the site since late 2002 when UN monitors were expelled from the country. It remains unclear how much access the U.S. team will be given of the nuclear site. The U.S. is considering sending a high-profile humanitarian mission to Iran headed by Senator Elizabeth Dole of North Carolina to help survivors of the earthquake that killed tens of thousands of victims. If Iran approves, the delegation will be the first official U.S. visit to the country since 1979, when Iranian students took 52 Americans hostage after the United States accepted into the country the deposed Shah. Israel has announced plans to double the number of Jewish settlers living in the Golan Heights, which Israel captured from Syria in 1967. This comes as Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has demanded a complete Israeli withdrawal from the region. The Associated Press is reporting that Israel is increasingly concerned over the forthcoming release of a former nuclear technician who's been jailed for the past 18 years for espionage. The scientist, Mordechai Vanunu, was jailed in 1986 after he gave the London Sunday Times top secret information about Israel's nuclear weapons program. Israel's Channel 2 TV station is reporting that Israel's considering how to silence Vanunu once he is released. The government's considering barring him from traveling overseas or from speaking in public after his release. The New York Times is reporting that CBS paid pop singer Michael Jackson $1 million for an interview after he was arrested on 7 counts of child molestation. Citing an unnamed colleague of Jackson's, the New York Times reports CBS offered Jackson a package deal that included an interview and the rights to produce a music special. Jackson and CBS both deny the charge. In Brazil, the government has begun photographing and fingerprinting all new U.S. visitors to the country. The move was ordered by a Brazilian judge as retaliation for new U.S. policies. Starting on Monday, citizens of many countries, including Brazil, who need a visa to enter the United States, will be fingerprinted and photographed when they pass through immigration at major U.S. airports and seaports. And leading Pentagon advisor Richard Perle has co-authored a new book entitled An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror, in which he calls for regime change in Syria and Iran, as well as a Cuba-style blockade of North Korea. Perle's co-author is David Frum, President Bush's former speechwriter. The book also said Saudi Arabia and France should be treated not as allies, but as rivals and possibly enemies. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers on this second day of 2004, perhaps one of the most momentous years in American history that we're about to unfold now. It's about to unfold.
And Happy New Year, Juan.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year to all of our listeners and viewers. It's also a time to reflect back on the year and look forward. And we at Democracy Now! Welcome all the new viewers and listeners. We are now moving in on 200 Pacifica radio stations, Pacifica affiliates, NPR stations, as well as public access TV stations around the country and broadcasting on Free Speech TV, our partners in Boulder, Colorado, Channel 9415 on the Dish Network. And we wish you all a very, very happy new year in this momentous week that marks two major anniversaries, the 10th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising and the implementation of NAFTA, January 1st, 1994, and the 200th anniversary of Haiti.
And we're going to begin with Haiti. This year, as Amy says, marks the 200th anniversary of the Haitian Revolution. Born of a slave revolt, the territory the French called Saint-Domingue won its independence through a revolutionary struggle that triumphed on January 1st, 1804. Before that, it was France's most lucrative colony for over a century. More than 500,000 African slaves produced sugar, rum, cotton, tobacco, and indigo. When they rose up and demanded their freedom and then defeated Napoleon's army, President George Washington and Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, both slave owners, supported France in its efforts to suppress the slaves. This week, Haitians are marking the anniversary with large celebrations. Yesterday in the Haitian capital, there were clashes between police and protesters. Opponents of the government staged a march through downtown Port-au-Prince, where tens of thousands of government supporters rallied outside the National Palace, as President Jean-Bertrand Aristide told them, quote, 1804 was the stinging bee, 2004 is sure to be the honey.
President Aristide listed 21 goals he hopes to accomplish by 2015. From stabilizing the rate of HIV infection to reducing poverty, Aristide's term expires in 2006. He didn't say whether he expects to be in office in 2015. He said, quote, it is possible to build a new Haiti because of what is on our flag, and that is united we are strong. Aristide then flew by helicopter to the site where the revolutionaries declared independence from the French. Today, we are going to take a look back at the roots of the Haitian Revolution and the state of Haiti today. In a moment, we'll go down to Port-au-Prince to speak with Kim Ives, the editor of the Haitian newspaper Haiti Progrès. But first, we hear a portion of the documentary Haiti, Killing the Dream. It's produced by Hart and Dana Perry. The script was written by Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! With Crowing Rooster Productions. This is Haiti, Killing the Dream.
Haiti is located on the western part of the island Hispaniola, which it shares with the Dominican Republic. The French turned it into their most profitable slave colony. But in 1791, the slaves revolted. By 1804, the slave armies defeated Napoleon's legions, making Haiti the first independent black republic in the world. Fearing the example would spread, the United States refused to recognize Haiti, beginning an uneasy relationship between a country founded by slaves and one founded by slave owners. At the turn of the century, America's view of Haiti was summed up by Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, who said, "Dear me, think of it, niggers speaking French."
You know, more than 2 years before we entered World War I, we decided we had to control Haiti.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
Haiti, in 1915, chief city of an island nation torn by internal troubles. Behind these scenes of peace and semi-tropic tranquility, there's uneasiness and unrest.
The U.S. government wanted to control the strategic windward passage between Haiti and Cuba, the major shipping route to the Panama Canal and the Pacific. So they created a pretext to justify a military intervention.
Then in 1915, United States Marines land in Haiti to battle Haitian bandits threatening destruction of American properties, and native bandits quickly head for the hills. This puts immediate end to troubles in populated areas, but Marines prepare to drive into interior and rout the insurgents out.
The arrogance with which we went about it, when you think of a young Franklin Delano Roosevelt as an assistant secretary of the Navy, bragging. I can see him there bobbing on the deck now, and he's writing the Constitution for the free people of Haiti. There can't be a more imperialist mentality than that. These people are too dumb to write their own Constitution. I have to do it for them.
Haiti's own Darty Guenave is elected provisional president, and the riot-ridden republic begins to function as a nation once again. Here are troops of the Palace Guard, but United States Marines are ever present.
It was a murderous, bloody intervention which destroyed the constitutional systems, reinstated slavery. The Marines stayed there for 20 years. What they left behind them was a military force, a National Guard, which essentially took over and has been run and ran it under one or another dictatorship since.
Noam Chomsky.
In 1957, the United States propped up the regime of Haiti's most feared president, François Duvalier. Known as Papa Doc, he was a country doctor who became a despot. To ensure he would not be overthrown by the army like his predecessors, Papa Doc built up his own vigilante militia, the infamous Tonton Macoutes. Volunteers for the Macoutes were paid by having free license to steal and extort from the people they tortured, raped, and murdered. Toward the end of his life, Duvalier cemented his ties to Washington and arranged for his son, Jean-Claude, to succeed him. After Papa Doc's death in 1971, 19-year-old Baby Doc took over as president for life. Baby Doc plundered the national treasury and, with army support, turned Haiti into a major drug transshipment stop. In 1986, a popular uprising ended the three decades of Duvalier dictatorship. Baby Doc was flown into exile aboard a U.S. government jet, taking a vast fortune and leaving behind a devastated but relieved country. After years of living in fear, the Haitian people exploded, taking revenge on the most abusive Tonton Macoutes and the déchoucage, or uprooting, of the Duvalier oppression. Some Macoutes who committed capital crimes suffered the popular justice called Père Lebrun, or necklacing. A tire, filled with gasoline, was placed around their bodies and burned.
The transitional government that was named after Duvalier, Jean-Claude Duvalier, fell was an army-led government, the CNG. And the army has shown little willingness to stay out of political affairs since then. There have been seven or eight coups since 1986, and the army has been involved in every one of them.
And that was the New York Times' Howard French from the documentary Haiti, Killing the Dream, narrated by Ozzie Davis. It was written by Juan Gonzalez. And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we go to Port-au-Prince, where Kim Ives is standing by, editor of Haiti Progrès. And joining us in our studio is Jocelyn McCullough. He is the head of the National Coalition of Haitian Rights. Stay with us. And you are here with Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest in the studio, Jocelyn McCullough, Executive Director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. And joining us by telephone in Port-au-Prince is Kim Ives, editor of the Haitian newspaper Haiti Progrès. Let's go down to Port-au-Prince first. Kim Ives, can you tell us about Independence Day, 200 years later? What happened in Port-au-Prince yesterday?
Well, Amy, it was a surreal day. Surreal in the sense that if you were to read the press and the NCHR press releases in New York, you'd get the sense that Haiti was coming apart at the seams, that there was a uprising against the government in some form or another. In fact, the uprising was to celebrate Haitian independence. So there were tens of thousands of people throughout the streets of Haiti on Sunday night, on December 31st, celebrating independence out in the streets, singing, dancing. It was just incredible to behold. The next day you had, and it was really ironic, you had in front of the palace tens and tens of thousands. I would estimate between 200,000 and 400,000. AP said 10,000. They upped it to 15,000 when some people protested. And this is what has been become the hallmark of coverage, is just this total media distortion of what's going on. That afternoon, the opposition, supported by Washington, has carried out a some kind of action where they marched, and their modus operandi now is they announce a march and then they change the route. So the police are faced with this provocation on each occasion. They had to stop them from taking their direction. They used some gas. The opposition march had prepared for this. They had tires, cinder blocks. This was in Port-au-Prince yesterday afternoon after the celebrations in the morning. And they threw everything into the street, created barricades. Finally, they were dispersed, and they went on a rampage through the areas of Nazon, La Lue, and other parts of the city, tearing up storefronts, smashing car windows. So it was a real attempt to wreck the day. In Gonaïve, something similar happened. There was a ceremony. They held it. They said they were going to shoot it up and stone it up. They didn't do that to the actual ceremony, but as people were leaving Gonaïve, they stood behind a row of houses going out of the city and pelted cars with rocks, and some cars had their windows shot out, too. So this is the kind of action the opposition is undertaking to terrorize people and destabilize.
Well, let's,
I think it's ironic.
Let's talk about the significance of today, Jocelyn McCullough with the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. For people who don't follow the details of Haitian politics today, this 200th anniversary, we heard the beginning of the documentary, The History. Can you take us forward to how we got to this point?
Well, I mean, when the Haitians when Haiti became a nation 200 years ago, as the clip that you showed demonstrated, Haiti was isolated from the rest of the world. Haitians had vanquished over the some of the fiercest and strongest armies in the world, Napoleon's army, and Napoleon was conquering, you know, vast areas of Europe, but that tiny little part of the island of Saint-Domingue, he could not vanquish because the slaves were ready, willing, to die for freedom and for their liberty. They didn't no longer wanted to be, remain oppressed. So Haiti was isolated. The United States did not really assist Haiti, even though Haiti became the second independent republic in the Western Hemisphere. The fear was that Haitian revolution was going to spread to the other colonies. And you also have to remember that during the time when Haiti became independent was also the time when the cotton gin became a huge moneymaker for plantation in the South. And in fact, the United States imported more slaves during that time than the other colonies, than the other powers in the world. So there was a very big contradiction there. Because Haitians were isolated, because a lot of the people who ran the colony fled the colony, there was a lack of technology. The resources, the plantations had been destroyed completely, so they had to be rebuilt. And the people who were in the country then had to sort of make do with whatever they could. So they rebuilt the country, but in a very difficult context, not unlike the context in which the countries that freed themselves from colonialism, from the yoke of imperialism, found themselves in recent years. So those are the issues.
And one of the important realities that most Americans are not aware of, isn't it that the French, rather than paying reparations to the Haitians for all those years of slavery, actually exacted reparations from Haiti for its independence, and that Haiti spent the most of the 19th century paying off the reparations to France. As I understand, President Aristide is now trying to get back some of those reparations from France.
That is correct. I mean, part of the success of the Haitian Revolution was also hinging on the fact that for them, they wanted to so safeguard their freedom that they spent a lot of resources in building fortifications around the country, one of which remains today one of the most magnificent constructions in the world, the Citadel de Ferrière in Cape Haitien in the north. Eventually, the Haitian leader, Jean-Pierre Boyer, decided that they were going to sort of make peace with France, and France exacted, as you said, a heavy price for that. President Aristide has embarked on has called for restitution, for reparations to the country, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, I mean, his appeal for restitution, reparation, is being done in the context in which he is increasingly isolated. His policies are not very popular. So there is not a national consensus on this issue of reparation and restitution, which makes that demand far weaker than it would have been otherwise.
Kim Ives in Port-au-Prince, after the big event of more than 15,000 people outside the palace, President Aristide took a helicopter to Gonaïves. This is a site of Haitian independence, also the site of a major massacre more than a decade ago. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. And as I say, Amy, it was on the order of between 200,000 and 400,000 people who were out in front of the palace. The helicopters were taken up, as I say, part of the campaign. And this is really a photocopy, an exact duplicate, practically, of what's been happening in Venezuela, the destabilization campaign. And they wanted to do the everything they could to disturb, upset, and make these ceremonies a mess. And that's what happened. I just want to say, if I get cut off, my landline is free because this cell phone may break off. The end result was a number of people were afraid to go up to Gonaïves, and they had an estimated about 5,000 to 6,000 people who went out there, ringed. There was a lot of gunfire in the area where what they call the armed opposition is operating in the area of Rabateau, and that massacre that happened in 1994, in April of 1994, the Rabateau massacre has been one of the accomplishments of the government. They did manage to convict a number of actors in that, as well as a number of those who were out of the country, the leaders of the coup d'etat, including General Raul Cedras, presently in Panama under U.S. With U.S. blessing. So this is one of the ironies that they've been able to use the very terrain where massacres were carried out against the population to now launch attacks trying to destabilize Haiti's independence.
Kim, one question, though. There have been, since President Aristide has been in office now for two terms after the U.S. Occupation to reinstall him, there definitely is a left opposition that has developed that feels that his regime has not, or his presidency has not, fulfilled the kinds of aspirations that the people had. And there was recently a battle at the university where some opposition students were attacked by pro-Aristide people. Could you talk about that a little bit, and what have been some of the contradictions that have developed within the movement for progress in Haiti?
Yeah, well, of course, it's an extremely complicated and complex process, but to me, the essence of it is just going back to independence. You had an independence war, which was also very complicated. You had the Afranchi, the freedmen, you had the former slave masses, and essentially at one point in that struggle, the Afranchi, the formerly freed, who often had some considerable wealth, allied themselves with those newly freed slave masses under the leadership of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and they managed to throw out the French. But they found that Dessalines had a vision which was a little too radical. He wanted to give the land to all the peasants and had a pan-Africanist vision at the time. And they said, this won't do, and they assassinated him in 1806. The Afranchi, they conspired even with the slave-owning powers of the time, the U.S. and France, according to some historians. And in the end result, the what we're seeing now is an attempt to retake over that power, because those the people, the descendants of those formerly freed slave mass, of those newly freed slave masses, essentially put President Aristide in power, and so they're doing their utmost to cut off the people from their vote, from their from what they selected. I think what we've seen is fomenting of an opposition movement, which is very artificial. Sure, the Aristide government has. You have criticisms that could be made of it, but this is primarily because he seems to be trying to reconcilable irreconcilables. When we talk about the student movement, we have to realize students in this society are a privileged strata, which and even among the students, it's just a fraction of the students who are creating these demonstrations. I find it ironic that, again, the media, the AP, the mainstream media, will refer to these marches, saying there's 50,000 who marched in latest, when in fact there were about 3,000 to 5,000 who marched. So you see this inflation of this Washington-supported opposition's demonstrations. You see a deflation of, for example, the bicentennial celebrations that happened on yesterday and on the night of the 31st. And what's important for people to understand is there is a complete media campaign to portray Haiti as some sort of dictatorship, as some sort of...
If I can, for one second, Kim, just to get our other guest in here for a second, you're shaking your head as you hear Kim say something?
Well, I mean, I'm shaking my head at the notion that it's a media campaign against Haiti. I mean, I don't think that the messenger should be blamed. The situation in Haiti has become far worse under the second term of President Aristide than it has been in a long time. And that is the situation that has fueled discontent with his government, and that is a situation that has essentially led our organization, National Coalition for Haitian Rights, along with a number of Haitian organizations, Haitian human rights groups, women's rights groups, students groups, you know, to say that the human rights violations under this government have become far worse and far more systematic in the single attempt by President Aristide and his government to remain in power and not to tend to the concerns and the appeals of the population in Haiti. And those appeals are very, very clear. I mean, it's not about trying to trying to rob the Haitian people of their dues. In fact, you know, one of the things I'd love to see in the country is in fact more realization of more of the promises or the goals that President Aristide has stated yesterday in his 21-point salute to Haiti. But the problem here is that, you know, I cannot stand here and say that this is any new thing, first of all, because one, there's a loss of goals that have been adopted by the international community. In fact, the magic year of 2015 is a year adopted by the UN to see a number of progress indicators in the world. And so Haiti would only be following the international trend, not setting its own goals. And its own goals have to be based on what the country has to do now, not simply appease people.
What do you think of this assessment? I mean, you have the coup from 91 to 94 that Juan and I both covered in Haiti, a time when you had the leaders, particularly among them Emmanuel Constant, the paramilitary leader, supported by the U.S. government, by the CIA, by the DIA. It's one of the reasons that James Woolsey was forced out as director of Central Intelligence, that this guy, Emmanuel Constant, was on the payroll of the intelligence agencies in this country, and that the only way they would allow Aristide to return, he had been elected in a landslide as a popular priest, was if he gave up his populist platform, like increasing the minimum wage, one of the first things he ever did. And so when he returned in a U.S. military jet, everything changed. And that we now leap forward 10 years. And the question is, whose agenda is he serving now? Do we see a return to what he first campaigned on when he first became president, or do we see something very different that the Western community will accept, but that is not very good for Haiti?
Well, I'm not sure. I think Aristide is really caught between a rock and a hard place, and that he is trying to follow or to use his populist roots to remain as popular as possible. But at the same time, and that leads them, you know, to sort of say, I'm not going to be a U.S. puppet. I'm not going to be the puppet of France or the international community. I'm just going to be my own man. But at the same time, is not delivering on the goods with respect to what the Haitian people themselves are expecting. And they expecting, I personally expected that there would be more freedoms in Haiti today. And unfortunately, those freedoms don't exist. Now, going back to what happened in 1991, to the period 1991-1994, it was obvious that when Aristide was elected back in 1990, even though he was elected through a free and fair election, which, you know, I personally witnessed and observed, and one of the greatest scenes that I will always remember is a scene of elderly citizens, Haitians who were invalid, who stood in line for hours, you know, to use the ballot and speak their mind. And that is something that has remained with me for quite a long time, and that is why I'm still in that struggle for these people who did it. But very quickly, part of the reason why Aristide was, why the military was able to move against Aristide, is that back in 1991, he had begun to lose the support of the people who voted him into office, so which created the opportunity for the military to move in without much opposition to the coup d'etat. Even though, you know, basically, once people woke up and said, well, these guys have taken away our freedom.
Well,
our
if vote. I could interrupt you for a second, is it that the lack of public support made it possible for the coup d'etat to occur, or is it that a lesson that Latin America has learned often, that you can't make revolution by the ballot box? That in essence what happens is what happened to Allende in Chile, what's happened to some degree to Chavez right now. The only difference between Chavez is that he's got a military background and he's got military backing, but that you can't make a real social revolution by a ballot box, because eventually the forces of reaction come down on you. And if you don't have a counterforce, an organized counterforce, whether it's military or organized political party, you are going to be overthrown or you are going to be crushed initially.
And one, I would agree with you. In fact, that's what I'm pointing out. There was not an organized counterpoint. There was not an organized political party. In other words, part of what happened here is that once Aristide became president, power became personal. It was no longer a structured the situation that allowed it to happen.
Well, I want to thank you, Johnny McCullough, for joining us, Executive Director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights, and Kim Ives in Port-au-Prince right now, editor of Haiti Progrès. When we come back from our break, we're going to another anniversary. It's the 10th anniversary of the Zapatista Revolution and the implementation of NAFTA, January 1st, 1994. Stay with us.
Toda una vida estaría contigo. No me importa en qué forma, ni cómo ni cuándo, pero junto a ti. Toda una vida,
en una vida así,
te estaría mimando.
Estaría cuidando
como cuido mi vida, que la vivo por ti.
No me cansaría
de decirte siempre,
pero siempre, siempre,
que eres en mi vida ansiedad, angustia y desesperación. Toda una vida,
en una vida así,
estaría contigo.
No me importa en qué forma, ni dónde, ni cómo,
pero junto a ti.
And you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we move from one revolution to another. 10 years ago on January 1st, 1994, a primarily indigenous rebel group, the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or EZLN, declared war on the Mexican government. They yelled, "Ya basta, enough," and announced that NAFTA, which went into effect the same day, meant death to indigenous people. Throughout the following decade, the EZLN has been a key reference for anti-globalization struggles around the globe. On the 10th anniversary of the uprising that shook the world, we bring you this special report recounting the major events of the past decade. It was produced in Chiapas by the Indy Media Center with in partnership with Free Speech Radio News.
On January 1st, while the rest of Mexico was celebrating the start of the new year, and President Carlos Salinas de Gortari, along with the country's political elite, were toasting the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the EZLN was mobilizing to take over five major towns in the state of Chiapas. Shortly after midnight, poorly armed women and men took over the towns of Ocosingo, San Cristobal, Altamirano, Las Margaritas, and Comitán. The uprising was a shock, even for those who for years worked in the very communities where the rebel army had been secretly organizing.
By 1992, what we saw was a very complicated panorama. We saw all of the peasant organizations divided and fighting with each other. Nothing is ever going to happen here, I thought. On January 1st, I was driving home and was stopped by dozens of armed men. Cabrones, I yelled. Where the hell have you been? We've been waiting for you.
Gaspar Morquecho, a local journalist who now owns a bookstore in San Cristobal, recounts the first hours of January 1st, 1994.
The central plaza had already been taken. I became more drunk than I already was, and the Zapatistas just looked at me. Then a curious thing happened, something I didn't expect. All sorts of people arrived and began to talk to the armed men and women, to ask them questions, to ask what they wanted. They approached the Zapatistas because they were sure that the war wasn't directed against them. Those conversations happened throughout the first part of the day.
Within less than 24 hours, that almost jovial spectacle turned into full-fledged warfare as thousands of Mexican military and police forces confronted the rebel army and terrorized civilian populations. In one indigenous village, Morelia, all the men of the community were rounded up and three elders were assassinated. Sister Patty ran a small popular hospital in Altamirano and was accused by the military of hiding weapons in the San Carlos hospital. She remembers that day.
On the 5th of January in the afternoon, the Federal Army arrived. It was a day of incredible silence, an environment of great fear. The military began to give out food to the people. And when the families went to receive their food, many of the men were taken by the military, tortured, and taken to the prison Cerro Hueco.
During those 12 days of warfare, approximately 200 people were killed, most of them civilians. The images broadcast throughout the world of the corpses of poor indigenous men lying on the dirt with wooden guns by their side made people wonder what was behind the decision to risk their lives. In February 1994, the Zapatistas again entered San Cristóbal de las Casas, this time to begin the peace negotiations. From the cathedral, Comandante Cebedeo spoke about the importance of peasant and indigenous people's right to land.
We decided to go to war so that the peasants could have land, not the ranchers. It wasn't for one village nor for the state, but rather for everyone who doesn't have land.
Again, Doña Rosita.
De una manera
natural, there exists among the people of San Cristobal a feeling of racism, which is viewed as very normal. During the first interviews after the uprising, the people here were asked, "What is your opinion on the situation?" And they said, "Well, this is a very serious problem, because really we have always lived like this, with the Indians and their communities, with their tranquil way of life, and us here. The Indians understand very well that they are Indians, that they have to live this way, that we live in another manner, and there has never been any conflict."
It was against this racism that the Zapatista communities decided to take up arms, in the words of Comandante Tacho.
It was at the dawn on the 1st of January 1994 when we appeared, because of the conditions and the situation in which we live, here in these mountains. We rose up in arms not so we could have somewhere, an office or some other important place to go. We took up arms so we would not be killed by forgetfulness, so that these demands would be heard, and that they would see that in this corner, in this country, Mexico, there are indigenous people who have been abandoned for many years.
The EZLN was officially founded 20 years ago, on November 17, 1983, in a remote guerrilla camp in one of the farthest corners of the Lacandon jungle. Subcomandante Marcos, military leader of the EZLN, describes what those years were like.
When the first group arrived in 1983, 1984, we were in the densest part of the jungle, in Montes Azules. We were talking about a group of four or five, six people that repeated to themselves every day, "This is the right thing to do, the right thing to do." There was nothing in the world telling us this was the right thing to do. We were dreaming that someday all of this would be worth something.
Remembering 10 Years of Zapatismo. This is a documentary that was produced by the Chiapas Indie Media Center together with Free Speech Radio News. And we go now to Chiapas, to Tim Russo, who is the Free Speech Radio News correspondent in Chiapas. Welcome to Democracy Now! In just a minute, Tim, could you tell us about this 10th anniversary and what people in Chiapas are doing?
Okay, good morning, Amy. Sure. What we've seen the last couple of days is thousands of people from around the world that flocked here to Chiapas and above all to the communities, the Zapatista communities, the five caracoles that was mentioned in the documentary were the five cultural centers of resistance that the Zapatistas inaugurated on the 8th of August this year, which is sort of the crux point of the Zapatistas' 10 years of struggle is coming to a head with the creation and the formation of the Council for Good Governments or the Juntas de Buen Gobierno. So thousands flocked in from around the world and pretty much divided into small little groups of affinity groups that came from Italy, from Argentina, from United States, and went into the five caracoles, to La Realidad, to Francisco Gomez, to 17th of November, to Roberto Barrios, and to the Highlands in Oventique, where we saw very local parties that were put together by the different juntas de buen gobierno, or councils of good government. I went out to Francisco Gomez with several other people from the Chiapas Independent Media Center, and there was a picture where about 1,500, 2,000 members of the communities, Zapatista communities from that zone that abarks Francisco Gomez, had come in and began to build their templates where they were going to have several different bands play and commemorate these 10 years of autonomy. They 11 o'clock hour of the Mexican government, or 12 o'clock the Zapatista insurgent hour, inaugurated the new year, and they did so with speeches given by the Council of the Good Government and several comandantes that were at the scene. They wanted to reiterate the importance of the formation of the Juntas de Buen Gobierno as just a very crucial movement in the struggle for Zapatistas and the autonomous projects that they've been working on to maintain their own autonomy and really implement what the federal government has never respected, which was the San Andreas Accords and self-determination for indigenous peoples here in Mexico.
Tim Russo, we'd like to bring in now someone we have here in our studio, Clara Nieto, who's written an excellent new book, Masters of War, Latin America and U.S. Aggression from the Cuban Revolution Through the Clinton Years. And welcome to Democracy Now!, Clara.
Thank you.
And I'd like to ask you, if you can, to put what's happening in Mexico right now in the 10th anniversary of the Chiapas Revolt, or what's happening in Haiti, in the larger context, as Latin America moves forward into 2004, what are some of the major problems and forward motion that you see occurring throughout the hemisphere?
Well, let's say the question of the Zapatistas, I think, is to start with, is a totally different sort of revolution. In the sense, you know, that they are not as happened, for instance, when I treat in this master war, you know, military movements against, to take power. That happened in Argentina, that happened in Brazil, that happened in Chile, and then happened in Uruguay, and in Central America, and so forth. I mean, the Zapatista there is changing inside the government, not taking it, but change and get the conscience of the people about the importance of the indigenous people who are a very important part of Mexico. And, you know, the question of Haiti, you know, I think, of course, they are not any longer under dictatorship, that they have a very tragic life about that, but nevertheless is struggling to get things done, I mean, to get justice done. You know, the question that I think is interesting in this moment in Latin America, that things are changing. In the sense that many recent events show that change. For instance, you know, the movement, the indigenous movement of the Bolivia, that they achieve, you know, to put out the president because they were not in accord with that. Also in Ecuador, that, you know, the Gutierrez was elected mainly with the support of the indigenous, and they now, they say they are already fed up with him because they say they don't know doing what they promise in the campaign. And you see, for instance, even we have to talk about what happened in Cancun, I mean, with the World Trade Organization, what happened with the American free trade. And I mean that this is a opposition of certain imposition from the United States. I mean that now they have a movement of, you know, of we don't want to be more pushed by, but let us do it in things that is better for our people and for our countries. And I think in that context, you know, I think that the Chiapas movement, the Mexican movement, led by the charismatic Comandante Marcos, gave a message to the indigenous people in Latin America that you have, you know, in many countries, you have this very a high percentage of indigenous people. I mean, the way that they should work or get united to achieve something for them.
But in terms of the, as you're saying, the turn in many of the countries in Latin America, really what seems to be occurring not only is an indigenous movement that's getting much more involved in the political in political battles, but also there seems to be more of a turning away across the continent from the neoliberal policies of the 80s and 90s and backed by the United States and by the forces of a global capital. But this has happened before in Latin America. I mean, you've had José Santos Zelaya, for instance, in Nicaragua in the early 1900s, and you had the Allende government in the 70s in Chile. You've had even movements of democratization, but the United States always seems to beat them back.
Yes.
And eventually reassert its dominance once again. And some people are questioning right now whether Lula in Brazil is not already moving to accommodation more than when he came in. And what's your sense of the ability of the United States to reassert its dominance throughout Latin America?
Well, we are seeing that now. I mean, this is very determined government in Washington. I mean, invade Iraq, invade Afghanistan, promise to do, I mean, change regimes here and there. You know, for instance, certain intervention in states, it's no question that he, for instance, in my country, in Colombia, it's no question that he did as he's doing in Iraq. But, you know, that the government, the president, is very much in accordance with what Bush is saying. And now we have military people taking care of our pipelines in Colombia.
U.S. military, yes.
Yes, U.S. military. You know something, you know, they say it's no question that the United States has responded inside the government with certain groups of people in power, you know.
Clara Nieto, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. Her book is Masters of War, Latin America and U.S. Aggression, from the Cuban Revolution through the Clinton Years. And that does it for our anniversaries show, from Haiti to Mexico. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, Johnny Sender, Rich Kim, John Randolph, Chris Zucker, Karen Renucci, Dennis Moynihan, Eric Romemu, Jenny Filippazzo, Isis Phillips, Carmen Mitchell. And also special thanks to Rick Rowley and Jackie Suen with Big Noise Tactical Media. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!